This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 129, where CJ and I are going to do a little update on the latest news in the Microsoft Cloud world, talk about dog fooding in the cloud, and have a couple picks for you as well. Recorded live, May the 10th, 2016.
Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by ValidNL. Valid is a Microsoft Gold partner whose mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of technology. Valid is always on the lookout for consultants, architects, and engineers. Do you know Azure, Business Intelligence and Analytics, .NET, Office 365, or SharePoint? Look them up on valid.nl.
Good morning, CJ. How are you?
Very well, AC. Very well. It's a gorgeous day here, so I'm all motivated and ready to go.
Hey, it's a gorgeous day here in Florida, but I can't wait to get out of it.
It's definitely summer up here in Seattle now, I tell you.
It's good. Yeah. I'm looking forward to in a couple of days. I'm going to, this time next week, by the time this show comes out, I should be sitting on a beach in on the Pacific coast of Mexico doing nothing, maybe sleeping, maybe reading, maybe just trying to focus on the horizon. I don't know.
I'm not doing anything.
I'm going to be on vacation for a week.
Full R&R mode.
Absolutely. It's a combo 40th birthday for myself, for my wife who turns 40 while we're there, and a 15-year wedding anniversary, which is actually coming up in two more days.
Nice.
Yeah. So what you been up to?
Oh, man. Well, last week I told you I was knuckles deep in XAML. This week I've just been tidying that off, and now I'm writing some Windows service code, strangely enough. Yeah. So out of the XAML, but still in C#. So
gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Still in the Microsoft Dev world, that's for sure.
Yeah. The last week I spent a good amount, we'll talk a little bit about it, but I spent a good amount of time doing some Orchard Dev and then also doing some work with the Azure management REST APIs, spending a lot of time there. So enjoying it though. It's been a lot of fun.
Excellent. Very nice. So what do we got on the cards this week?
Hey, so we're going to break this up into two main components here for the show this week. First of all, we're going to talk about some news, some latest news that's come out. It's been a while since we've done one of these. So we're going to highlight the big things, or at least what you and I think are big things that we want to talk about over the last few weeks. And then we're going to talk a little bit about dog fooding. And then, I guess that's it. But hey, before we dive too much into it, just want to remind people, we do have a mailing list that we've started on the website. If you go to microsoftcloudshow.com, you'll see a link that pops up in the bottom right corner where you can sign up for our mailing list. You can also fill out a listener survey if you go to microsoftcloudshow.com/listener survey. We have not spammed anyone with our mailing list yet. Hopefully by the time you get this, we will have sent at least one email out letting you know about some updates that we've done. But the idea is that really to get your feedback, to find out what you're interested in, make sure that we're giving you guys the content that you're looking for, that we're not going off and riffing on things that are completely boring to you. As a sidebar, I've been incredibly pumped that we've had a lot of people talk about the geek out that we did with space, and they're asking for more. That's really cool.
Yeah, that was kind of nice. Nice to hear. It was a bit of a test for us, so it's good to hear it went down well.
Exactly, yeah. So you can feel free to give us your email address on the newsletter. It's an opt-in thing. You can opt out whenever you like if you don't want to get any more email from us, but we will never sell your email address to a sponsor, to anyone. We won't be hawking products and stuff on there. It's really just to communicate and to have a We want to have a better and a closer relationship with all of our listeners.
Exactly. Getting all squishy.
Exactly. Imagine a pipe and a Cavassier sitting by the fire. That's us and CJ and you.
Hey, that sounds like a great idea. Let's do that next episode.
There you go. Just not at 11 o'clock in the morning for me.
If I have a tumbler of scotch at 11 a.m., I'll be a happy chap. Yeah.
There you go. Hey, CJ, I got a bombshell to drop on us.
Ooh, what's that?
The first item we're going to talk about is called The Road to Hell is Paved with XAML Assertions.
Oh, this is an utter doozy of a screw up.
Yeah. Do you want to give us a little bit of a rundown on what this? This happened right before, or it happened a couple days before the May the 4th event for the Future of SharePoint event. We debated about actually doing a full-on show on this thing, and we decided it probably wasn't the best time to do it. But it's definitely something worth talking about. And
oh, yeah.
My take is Microsoft dodged a huge bullet. So let's...
Oh, man. Yeah, this is a total shocker. So for those of you who haven't heard about this, there's lots of acronyms and lots of technical terms in this article, but the nuts and the bolts of it, or the too long didn't read or explain it like I'm five, in a nutshell, anybody could have logged into Office 365 as anybody else for a period of time. Well, almost. I mean, there are some caveats to that, right? So basically what this vulnerability was for folks that used federated authentication. So for customers that used Office 365 that had it hooked up using federated auth to another system. So for example, ADFS for doing login using your on-prem AD credentials, for example, or a system similar to ADFS, right? Any other sort of federated identity system. What it was possible to do was me as a hijacker or a hacker, I could go and get an Office 365 tenant and hook it up to federated authentication and have that federated authentication system basically make a series of assumptions or assertions to say, hey, I'm actually BillG@Microsoft.com. And when it passed those assertions back to Microsoft when I was logging in, it would go, oh, cool, you're BillGates@Microsoft.com. And it would log me into BillGates@Microsoft.com's Office 365 account, which obviously doesn't sound right and really is not right at all. But it was an enormous vulnerability. And we really don't know how long it lasted or it was around for. But there was a chap who posted about this. He did a great write-up on his website, economyofmechanism.com. The article is called The Road to Hell is Paved with SAML Assertions. And he details the hack. Now, what I will say about this is they went about this the right way. So they found this vulnerability, and then back in January, they reported it to Microsoft. And within 7 hours of the vulnerability disclosure to Microsoft back in January, Microsoft had fixed it. It is such an enormous gaping hole that they really had no choice. So they went through the proper channels, and it was addressed in a reasonably timely fashion. I think 7 hours is pretty good for something like this. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until March or April, I think, that they put the blog post out and detailed it in full detail. So I certainly feel like they went about it the right way. But yeah, in a nutshell, there was a hole using federated identity with Office 365, which meant that I could log in to any customer that used federated authentication in their tenant, I could log in as them, and the Microsoft Auth system would be like, yep, cool, I'll let you in, and away you go.
Yeah, you really can't understate the potential impact that this could have had. The guy, like, I will agree with you that it is a shining example of how to best go about potential compromises that may happen in a vendor's system. So for example, for Office 365, in this case, where someone found something and reported it, and Microsoft has a program, as do many other companies, they have a program, it's called a bug bounty. And basically what it is that when you report this issue, you essentially work with Microsoft in secret, or at least in confidential, to notify them what you found, give them a chance to fix it, give them a chance to patch it. And if you do that, and what you found is legitimate, you're actually eligible to make some money off of it. So you can make anywhere from, I think, up to hundreds of dollars off this. And it was confirmed that whoever this individual, if it was either individual or if it was done as a firm, they are eligible for the bounty program. I haven't seen how much they would get, but I really can't understand. I can't think of another one that would have said that this is there's another potential vulnerability that this would be bigger than. Or that would be bigger than this.
Exactly, yeah. One of the things I read online was, especially there was a great Reddit post about this where there was a good discussion going on amongst Redditors. And I got into this argument with a guy that was basically like, this is the argument for why the cloud is terrible. And his argument basically was revolving around one point, which was, you know, it's a single point of failure, and and it's a bug in one place affects everybody. And I was like, well, let's think about this a bit more rationally. If this had occurred in on-premises vulnerability, right, say in ADFS, for example, imagine if ADFS suffered this. Do you think the path to resolution would really take less than 7 hours for everybody on the planet that used ADFS? Definitely not. They'd be lucky if it was all patched in 7 months. Mm-hmm. Right? Microsoft would put out a patch and then it would trickle out to customers over a period of months because we all know how responsive IT departments can be in patching. And they'd want to test it and do all that sort of stuff. And of course, they would follow their process. But it would take months to roll out. And my point was, this is a great example of why the cloud rocks, because I'm a glass half full kind of guy. And it's like, great, you patch it in one place as opposed to a million places and fix it up.
Yeah, it's that. And it's also the fact that, I mean, you've got some of the best highly paid and highly experienced security people are the ones that are on this, like they're on, like white on rice. I mean, they're on it. They were on it right away. They were addressing it. I mean, let's to kind of back up the point that you just made. How many of you that are listening to the show right now who are Office 365 customers were aware of this? Now, I'm guessing a bunch of people were aware of it, but if there's just a few of you that we're actually breaking the news for you, and we're breaking it 2 weeks after it actually became a big deal, or maybe it's a little bit over a week now, maybe not a full 2 weeks. Let's just say 10 days. If we're breaking this for you, as we're recording it, actually, sorry, you're going to get this in another 7 days. So it's going to be 2 or 3 weeks past it by the time the show comes out. If this is the first time you're hearing about it, then you didn't even know that this thing was going on. Now, I did talk to someone that, one of my confidential sources, I'll say, but I did talk to someone at Microsoft where this was a regression. This is not something that has been out there for up to like 5 years since Office 365 has been around.
Yeah.
I did talk to someone who said that this was a fairly recent regression and that it had only been like this for a short amount of time. They were still, at the time I talked to them, they're still trying to figure that out, but they feel confident that this had not been going on for more than a week, that someone had found, at the time they were looking at it, it was less than a week. So again, that's just hearsay, so I may be off my rocker there, but someone at Microsoft was telling me that was the case. So
that makes sense.
But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when you look at that, it's a pretty interesting post to the point where you can even see where this individual that found the problem, he demonstrated it, and then he even showed how he was able to even query Office 365 to find out who other companies that were federated. So he had companies listed like, I think it was Japan Airlines, Singapore Airlines, the United States Department of Defense, Microsoft.
Of course.
As a corporation, yeah. I could have gone in and created a trial account. And because there's no credit card tied to it, I could have gone in and gotten a little burner cell phone. I could have created a trial account. And within about 2 or 3 hours, I could have been reading Satya Nadella's email.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty, and we say that, you know, hey, look, nothing happened here. Who knows if someone was able to grab all this content and is sitting on, well, let's just call it the Redmond Papers because of the Panama Papers are going around. Who knows? Somebody may be sitting on this stuff right now and holding on to it for a certain amount of time or trying to hold something for ransom. But that's the scary thing about it is that it looked in the logs, it looks like the individual who that you're impersonating, it looks like they're the ones that's logged in.
Yeah, there's no end of how bad this is. Like being able to log in as anybody in a customer that used federated authentication, I think it's obvious how dangerous this was. I just found it hilarious I found it interesting that everybody jumped on, though. This is why you shouldn't go to the cloud. And for me, it's like completely the opposite because
agreed.
There are so many poorly patched and undermanaged on-prem systems that I still believe, even with a hole of this magnitude, I still believe that you're safer than the average person doing this stuff on-prem by using something like Office 365.
Absolutely. So we'll have a link to this in our show notes if you want to go read up on it. It is interesting reading, and it's just, I mean, it's if you like the nuts and bolts of how stuff works.
It's a very hardcore post, so prepare for acronym soup and lots of technical detail about SAML.
Yeah, this is not, this is not a, let me go grab my iPad and go sit on the couch and read this. This is a grab a cup of coffee and focus.
It does a very nice job of explaining it, though, so I think a lot of people will... You have to be technical, but a lot of people will get it. He's pretty clear about it. It's nice.
Hey, we got another one here. Over the time that we were, the last few weeks, Microsoft posted revenue of $20.5 billion in the third quarter of its 2016 fiscal year. It was down 6% from the same quarter a year ago, but this was huge. Operating income, $5.3 billion, a 20% drop. Net income was $3.8 billion, down 25%, and earnings per share were 47 cents per share is a little bit down. So everyone was like going, okay, it's all down stuff. But what was really crazy, though, was around the business around the cloud. So the commercial cloud annualized revenue run rate, that's kind of funny because that's the forecast number that the former CEO, Steve Ballmer, dismissed as, quote, a few yeah. months ago.
He doesn't like it. Yeah.
No. It crept up to $10 billion. 3 months ago, it was estimated to be around $9.4 billion. So we're looking at $10 billion for cloud revenue. That's Office 365. That's Azure. Is just absolutely exploding. And it was really up. It was Azure in the cloud is what really drove the really big numbers with this.
Yeah. It's a huge milestone for them. $10 billion. Now, this is not earned money. This is projected earned money over the next 12 months. So if they keep going at the way they're going, they expect to hit $10 billion in revenue over the next 12 months for that. A huge percentage of this is Office 365. Like, I can't really go into much more detail than that, but a big percentage of that is Office 365, and it's growing like wildfire. So good for them. I'm really pleased to see it's going so well. The other really interesting number was the consumer Office 365 number. Was it 22 million? They'd say up to 22 million subscribers now of Office 365.
Up 57%, doubled from 12.4 million to 22 million.
This is an incredibly important number for them because, you know, everybody that says Office is no longer relevant can like smoke that revenue pipe because it's 22 million people paying a yearly subscription for Office. That gets you Office on your iPad and all that sort of stuff with editing capabilities and all that sort of stuff. That is nothing to be sneezed at. It is a ton of revenue and that's just consumer.
Yeah.
So that's converting people off like crappy old versions of Office on Windows 95 and Windows XP to the latest version of Office in an ongoing annuity revenue stream, which can't be understated, right? It's really important to them.
Yeah, and I mean, so that's just the consumer side. If you look over at the Azure side, Azure revenue was up 120% with Azure Compute and SQL usage doubling year over year. Other little highlights from this too is that the personal computing revenue was $9.5 billion. That's up 1%. From the previous year, the Surface business was up 56% year over year. It was about $1.1 billion. So that was driven primarily from the Surface Pro 4 and the Surface Pro. Gaming was up 6% as well. So it was definitely a very good quarter for them. Very much on the cloud business and the subscription based business and ongoing business, and not so much people just upgrading Windows 10 or buying a Surface or something like that. This is like booked revenue that you can consistently count on as like a SaaS business.
Yeah. And there was a little milestone that they didn't mention along the way, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Which was that they surpassed $1 trillion in cumulative revenue. So basically, since the dawn of time, Microsoft has now made over $1 trillion in revenue in total, which is quite a big number when you think about it.
Just a bit.
Pretty big.
Yeah.
Apple have made more, strangely enough. They've made, I thought it was kind of interesting because they've made a lot of their money in the last 6 years, but they were at about $1.3 trillion, something like that, which is quite a lot. But here's the interesting thing. Cumulative revenue is all above $1 trillion. Microsoft and Apple are pretty much neck and neck for cumulative earnings. So profit, basically.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so they're all at about like 260 something billion in cumulative profit, which is quite a bit of cash.
Just a bit. That's a good number.
Yeah.
It's a good nest egg to sit on.
Here's the interesting thing. Amazon, cumulative profit, $3 billion, 3.3.
Wow.
Microsoft and Apple are up at 250. So although Amazon's cumulative revenue is now creeping up above $500 billion, they've only made 3.3.
Crazy. Absolutely crazy.
So they do a lot of throughput and not a lot of profit.
Yeah.
Hey, but what's a few billion between friends? I'd be pretty stoked if I made $3.3 billion in profit.
I'll take 1% of that. How's that?
But the interesting thing is this article, actually, we'll link to it in the show notes, but it says Microsoft revenue quietly surpasses $1 trillion. It's brutal on Amazon. He said, Amazon have made only, you know, $3.3 billion in profit. From the strictest capitalist standpoint, all its efforts and success have yielded little for shareholders. It's kind of been a net failure.
Ouch.
Ouch. Like
stinger.
Yeah, brutal, huh? Yep. And then it goes on to say that Washington State is the libertarian promised land, which he doesn't have very good things to say about the tax regime in Washington State and how much Washington State is missing out on taxes and in its own benefit from these businesses being here. Hey, but one might argue that they might not be here if that wasn't the case as well. So,
oh well, yeah. I remember when they were going to break up when the United States government wanted to try and potentially break up Microsoft with the whole the bundling of Internet Explorer. And yes, there was Bill Gates had the comment going, well, fine, we'll just jump across the border over to Canada.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, here's another really interesting thing. This guy's pretty down on the whole deal. You can tell he's pretty pissed about missing out on this tax revenue. But he said that 41% of Microsoft's all-time profit is held overseas.
God.
Yeah, $108 billion. In earnings is held offshore, which is 41% of its all-time profit. Fascinating.
Yeah, there's a political statement in there that I have strong feelings on, but yeah.
Just interesting. And then he goes on to say, Washington State's kind of this libertarian promised land and yada, yada, yada. They don't have enough money to pay for education, worst traffic in the country, record homeless, violent crime is up, native orcas are dying and salmon are endangered. Untreated nuclear waste facility, that's kind of a problem, and that we lack enough funds to build public restrooms for Amazon's abundance of male programmers. Nicely done, Bill and Jeff.
That's awesome.
So in summary, I'd say it's pretty down on the whole thing, but I just thought the numbers were pretty staggering and very interesting.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yes.
Okay, so another thing that we have here is Azure actually had a new feature that was announced that I took note of here. It was around the storage. And so what Microsoft has done, let me just back up for a second. So Amazon has had a feature with their storage, their S3 storage, where they had a mode called Glacier. And essentially what Glacier would allow you to do was to run take files that you had stored in S3 and not make them so readily accessible. Instead, what they would do is you would take that storage, you would say, I don't want it right now, but I'd rather submit a request. And within a couple hours, I want to be able to download, or within an hour or so, I want to be able to download it. And so instead of it being so quickly accessible, you can kind of put that data on slower and cheaper storage. And they called it Glacier. So Microsoft has not had something like, and they would do it for a much cheaper cost. Microsoft or Azure has not had this capability before before now. And of course, you know, you got to love the name. And Azure's was, or Amazon's was called Glacier Storage. And with Amazon, we have, or with Azure, it's called Cool Blob Storage.
Cool Blob Storage. Yeah, it's not as fast, right?
Exactly, it's not as fast. Now, it's a fraction of the cost. It's a little bit less than half of what you would normally spend. So today, if I'm looking at numbers on the East Coast, East US data center, your first terabyte and locally redundant storage is 2.4 cents per gigabyte for the first terabyte of storage. If you go up to geographically redundant storage, it's about almost 5 cents per gigabyte. The cool storage, though, is just 1 penny per gig. So it's super cheap.
Gosh, that's so cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, if you think about it, so I use Glacier on Amazon because Microsoft hasn't had this with Azure. And so now I got to decide if I want to move it over, but it's kind of a pain. I have two NAS devices in my house where I keep all my digital pictures and all my old work and all my music and all that kind of stuff, home movies and everything. And it totals about, I think, just because I have the storage and so I can save it, I think it's somewhere around like 15 terabytes, something like that.
Wow.
Cost me something like less than $10 a month with AWS. It would have cost me, though, closer to like $35 or $40 a month. But because it's just backup data, I don't need access to it right away. If there's a disaster and I lose both these NAS devices where I want to pull the data down, well, it's going to take me a long time to pull it down anyway. So I just need to put the request in saying make it to where I can actually get to it. And what they end up doing with Amazon, and I think that Azure does the same thing, is that it actually loads it from this cool storage into a normal blob so that then you have better access to it. So you put stuff into a blob, and then once you get it up into a blob, then Azure puts it off in this cool offline storage, and then we'll move it back over for you.
Yep, no, that's nice. I can imagine there's going to be some updates to various NAS devices and all that sort of stuff that help you with pushing your content off into Azure for cold storage.
Yeah, heck of a lot cheaper though. Nice little option there.
Yeah.
Last bit of news here that we got for us.
Yep.
This is cool. So anybody, you a developer?
From time to time.
There you go. Well, at least you play one on TV, right?
That's right. Nicely done. I see what you did there.
So we know that Microsoft has been working on the .NET Core and the ASP.NET Core, which is taking the .NET framework and ASP.NET and making them cross-platform, making it so that we can have run these on Linux, on OS X, on Windows. Well, they announced that they hit their RC2, the Release Candidate 2 milestone.
Yeah.
I have a link to this in the show notes. Talks about how they have had some great performance improvements. Actually, listened to a really good interview with Scott Hunter on the .NET Rock show, where they talked about some of the performance metrics that they've hit, which are just un-freaking believable, the numbers that they're hitting.
Yeah. They made a lot of speed improvements, right?
Oh, it's tremendous. It's something like, I forget exactly what he said, but I thought it was something like 1 million requests per second or able to hit up to 1 million requests per second, which it was just shy of this one Java framework, but there's one very popular site that does all these performance metrics, but they only do it to RTM version. So their tests are showing, Microsoft's tests are showing that they're going to exceed certain numbers, that certain metrics that are up there, but they have to wait for a little bit longer until actually can get in, but
yeah, gotcha.
They'd be seen as real stuff. But the big thing, the big news with this one is that they have committed to saying RC2, the runtime, the libraries will be available to us in mid-May. So by the time this episode comes out, but what's even more interesting is the release, the RTM of .NET Core and ASP.NET Core for the runtime and the libraries will be available by the end of June. The tooling will be previewed too, and it'll be bundled with that release. The tooling won't be RTM. That will make it when they RTM with Visual Studio codename 15. So that they haven't said when that's going to be. That'll trail it a bit. But they're separating the tooling from the actual framework stuff. So if you want to, like, use, say, Visual Studio Code to work with this stuff, you can. It just doesn't have all the tooling will be available in Visual Studio at the day of release.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Nice.
Cool stuff.
Good for some devs.
Absolutely. Really good for some devs.
Yeah. So what are we talking about today?
We had a tweet come in from Tim Farrow, and this is back mid-April, and he referenced a link to an article by, I think it's ZDNet or InfoWorld, well, one of the two, is InfoWorld, and it talks about the importance of dogfooding in the cloud. Let me just give it to you, the gist of it, and then you and I can kind of put our comments out there, and we'll have the link to this in the show notes. The title of the article is The Importance of Dogfooding in the Cloud. Amazon.com runs entirely on AWS EC2. For those of you not familiar, those are virtual machines and Amazon Web Services. And Microsoft runs Office 365, Skype, Xbox Live. All of those are run on top of Azure, Microsoft's cloud. But Google doesn't run any of its products on the Google Cloud platform. Here's why it matters. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, first how we think it matters. And then we've had this question come up a bunch here. So we figured, why don't we talk about how we use Azure specifically for the podcast?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I guess we don't just use Azure. We actually use a little bit of the Google Cloud platform too, but I mean, a smidgen. We're mostly Azure. So do you think the dogfooding stuff matters? Do you think it matters for a company that they're actually using their own cloud?
Enormously. Absolutely. I'm a firm believer on the Microsoft camp on this, strangely enough. Yeah. So Microsoft has had a very long history of dog fooding, and they actually do a very good job of it. Like, it's really impressive, especially as you know, if you work there, you see it in action of the way Microsoft IT's MSIT, Microsoft IT, runs a ton of their products in beta and alphas and all sorts of things. Obviously, they're running the entire company on Office 365's email service and all that sort of stuff. Well, a vast majority of it anyway. There's still some on-prem stuff, but most of it on Office 365. And it really does make a difference to their products. And so what I mean by that is, when you're a product team at Microsoft and Microsoft IT are using your stuff and rolling it out to the rest of your company, there is a certain level of, oh my goodness, we've got to fix this problem because we're affecting the whole company. you know, during an alpha or during a beta or something like that. And it just has a much higher impact on the people writing software if they know that their company is being affected by it. Sort of drives an urgency that you don't get. At least I think it drives an urgency that you don't get in other types of betas and alphas that I've seen anyway. And so the cloud's no different, right? Microsoft run, actually their Office 365 tenancy is on an earlier ring, deployment ring than the public version of Office 365. So they get the updates sooner than the public get them. And so they find problems faster than the public do. And it gives them a chance to go fix them. So they're still dogfooding in the cloud. They just do it slightly earlier, you know, in deployment rings than the public version of Office 365, which is great, right? Because it means they suffer the pain if they introduce a breaking change or some problem is or bug is introduced. They suffer first, which is the way it should be. And they're very motivated to go fix that because it brings the company to a halt.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's incredibly important. I mean, I think that you could almost argue that Amazon, I mean, you can make an argument that Salesforce really is the one that started this, but
yeah.
I think the real argument I think that everyone really looks at is you would look at Amazon as being the one to really start this whole cloud thing, where Amazon started to build up Amazon Web Services for their own use because they needed it. They needed to be able to scale. And then they found that they could productize this. They could start to sell this to other people. And so they did. They ended up building up the cloud. That kind of got other companies to wake up to it, like Microsoft. Microsoft started building Azure, then Office 365 moved to it. And so you see now that, I mean, I know that when I bank on Office 365, when I bank on Azure, when I bank on AWS, I feel comfortable that they're not going to go away. This isn't a product that's just going to disappear because these huge organizations depend on it and so many other companies out there really depend on it.
Yep.
The Google one is interesting. I mean, it's kind of, their cloud is interesting in the sense that you see that the way that they manage their entire infrastructure is with an internal system called Borg. And they've taken this Borg model of development. They have a special model that they use for development. It's very much like containers. They've taken Borg and they've productized and generalized it into a system called Kubernetes, which you've heard us talk about stuff with like Docker and with Mesosphere and Swarm and everything. Kubernetes I would see it as kind of a competitor to like Mesosphere or a competitor to like Docker Cloud.
Yeah.
And they've built this, but they don't run Google off of Kubernetes. They have Kubernetes as an offering for everybody else to use. They still run Google off of Borg. They use their own thing. Well, you see, let's switch it over. Let's look at what Microsoft is doing. Microsoft had a very different approach recently, which is for many years, they've been running something called, they call it now, I don't know if they called it before, Service Fabric. And that's what ran all the backbone of Azure. But now they're offering it out for customers to do it too. So you know that if you're using something called Service Fabric, this new feature, which we definitely need to have an episode, we talk a little bit more in depth on it. But this thing is a pretty big thing. It's a pretty core piece of Azure and it's what runs Azure. So I think it's a big deal. This dogfooding thing is important. You definitely get the beat the products up quite a bit and to find out where the problems are, but it's also a level of trust and a level of faith in picking something.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it is quite telling they don't use the same stuff that they sell. Although Microsoft's in a similar boat. I mean, Office 365 doesn't run on Azure per se. There's certainly some overlap there, but for the vast majority of it, doesn't run on Azure. It runs alongside it in many of the data centers and a lot of the shared infrastructure between the two, but not, it's not VMs running in Azure or anything like that.
Yeah, it's close. It's closer.
It's much closer, yeah.
I thought that, you know, we talked about this. We said, well, why don't we kind of share how we use the cloud to host the podcast? So
yeah.
We've done a lot of stuff recently, and I thought that why don't I just give a gist of how we host the site and everything, or how we host the podcast. And then you talk about some of the work that you've done recently. I talk about some of the work that I've done and how the cloud has actually helped us. So just from a really quick overview of it is that we have a website, microsoftcloudshow.com, and we have a bunch of MP3s. And all of the website is hosted or is implemented using a open source product that's actually part of the .NET Foundation called Orchard. It's an open source CMS. It's one of the most sophisticated MVC applications I've seen. It actually hosts the Cloud Show. It also hosts my blog as well. And I think Microsoft even uses it for a lot of properties for like the MSDN blogs. And they also use it for dev.office.com.
Yeah, it's used a lot. Yep.
It's hosted inside of an Azure web app. So it's just in a, today it's in a single medium instance. Get ready to downscale that too, because caching is being, the site's performing so well. And then all of the actual MP3s are stored in an Azure blob. So we have a custom domain that's pointing, custom CNAME that's pointing to a blob, and have an RSS feed that the that Orchard pushes out. We use FeedBurner to syndicate the RSS feed. So when you go to our RSS feed, feeds.microsoftcloudshow.com/Microsoft Cloud Show episodes, that's actually a FeedBurner URL that's consuming a dynamic, well, sorry, that's consuming an RSS feed from our site, spitting out all the results. So that's the nutshell. That's what we use to host the podcast. But we've done some stuff recently to, again, get a better idea into metrics and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So this used to be super painful for us, and it was a real problem area. So what we were doing was we put the MP3s into Azure Blob Storage, as you said, and we turned on Azure Blob Storage auditing or logs, right? And so what this does is it pops some blobs. In the dollar logs container in Azure Blob Storage, and they're basically CSV files with all of your access logs. So all the operations against your MP3s or your JPEGs or what have you that you have in Blob Storage are logged there. So things like, you know, data accesses, you know, downloads of your MP3s, queries for what's in those containers, and things like that, all go into those logs. And so what we were doing is we were manually pulling down all those logs. And let me just say that there are lots of those logs. So there's one file generated for every 5 minutes of activity, roughly. And so you get thousands and thousands of these things. So we're pulling all of those down, the CSV files. Our manual process was download them all, probably using a command line to do that, or AZ copy or something like that. I was doing some PowerShell to combine all of those logs, CSVs, into one file. Then I was using the SQL import tool to import that CSV into a temporary table in SQL. Then I was running a whole lot of T-SQL across the top of that table to clean it up. So I was doing data manipulation on dates, pulling out the episode numbers, cleaning up rows that we didn't want. So we just wanted the MP3 downloads. We didn't want the JPEG files and that sort of thing, logs for that. And we only wanted successful downloads. So I cleaned out all of those rows. Then once that was done, then I'd copy all of those rows into our actual log file, log table. And then finally, I was running a Node script on my laptop that was talking to a Docker container to do reverse geolocation on the IP addresses to update the location of where those downloads came from to the country, so we could see which part of the world our downloads were coming in. So if you didn't follow that, I'd summarize it was a royal pain in the
when CJ said that this was such a pain in the butt, we ran this every 5 months or
yeah, we didn't do it very often.
No, we didn't. It's honestly, it's one of the reasons why we didn't have a sponsor for so long, because they were asking, so give us some metrics on the site, and we're like, oh crap,
we've got to do it again.
Yeah. That was still, a lot of that was done fairly recently. The geocoding stuff was done, or reverse geocoding stuff was done fairly recently, and that was in response to our sponsor request.
Yeah, wanting to find out where in the world our listeners are. So anyway, yeah. So this was a very tedious and manual process, but we decided, hey, let's pull finger and actually do something about this. So we decided to use the new Azure Functions to help automate some of this. So now we have a series of Azure Functions that download the log files, parse the log files, and stuff them into SQL, and do the reverse geocoding. So it's a series of three Azure Functions. The first one grabs all of the log files and takes a copy of them, so we move them into a different location, and we keep track. That function keeps track of which when it last ran. And so it can go and just synchronize the log files since it last ran, give or take, with a little bit of overlap for safety. So it goes and grabs all those log files, copies them into a new location. Then we have another function that is triggered on those new log files showing up. So Azure Functions, you can trigger, you could do what's called a blob storage trigger. So when new files show up in your blob storage container, you can trigger a function. And so we use a trigger function on those blobs. When the new log files get copied into the right place, that function triggers, it opens them up, it parses the CSV files, It does the data manipulation that we were doing with T-SQL previously, so doing some data cleanup, user agent string manipulation, and so forth. And then it inserts a row for each of the rows that we're interested in into Azure SQL. And then finally, that function triggers, using an HTTP request, it triggers a third Azure function, which interrogates the database for rows that are missing their geotagging and goes and reverse geocodes them from their IP address to country.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a series of three things that happen in parallel, or in series, I should say. And the ultimate result is our logs are pretty much real-time as much as Azure's storage logging is real-time, which it's not. It can be up to an hour delayed in some instances, but for the most part, it's very close to a couple of hours or an hour or something like that within real time. So now we go report on all of that data using SQL and a Google Doc, and we get lots of nice WYSI charts and pretty pictures, and so we can see up to the minute, so to speak, analytics on how our episode download numbers are going.
I guess that's also part of a stopgap. Someone might have heard, like, wait, Google Sheet. Why are you using a Google Sheet for this and not Excel? So we have an Excel workbook that you created that you can open up, and it uses Power Pivot to go suck the data in, to do some slicing and dicing and show different pivot charts and stuff to get the latest data from the database. But I mean, both of us are primarily on OS X, and I got a little tired of having to go try to open up an Excel workbook, find a Windows machine to open Excel workbook up, because Power Pivot doesn't work in the browser and it doesn't work on OS X, to go refresh the data and then take that data and try and do some sort of analytics on it. So I created a Google Sheet that we have an admin that goes in once a month and tracks stats from, pulls, copies things in from Google Analytics to see website tracking, to pulling information from Twitter to see what our social presence is with Twitter. Same thing with Facebook, to get information out of Facebook. Some of you may have noticed that you may have seen some of our posts a little more often on Facebook. That's because we've actually tested out a little bit of advertising with Facebook to see my promoting a post. Pretty cool stuff there. But I took all that information plus the data that you've pulled in from that spreadsheet and through the process and put it in a Google Sheet, so that now we have separate worksheets in this Google workbook, but also have one that's like a dashboard that has just a bunch of charts, and we can see really as often as we update it, we can see latest stats on how the podcast is performing. That's something that we're probably going to end up changing. We're kind of playing around with Power BI right now to make it even more automated and a little bit cleaner. I know we played around with it a little bit at first, and both of us kind of banged our head against it a little bit, but we got to spend a little, going back to it, I'm going to give it another shot to hopefully get out of the worksheet, because it is a lot of data that we're pulling in, and a lot of it, all this stuff is automated. Most of the stuff is automated, and we can pull the stuff in. So nice to have a nice central dashboard to be able to not only look at it, but also drill in. So
yeah, I'd love to have something that's just live and we do zero work to get up to date. That was the goal, and we're really close, I think. But it was, it was really interesting. So that the Azure Function stuff is kick-ass for these sorts of things, right? It's super easy. I just wrote some C# for the functions and the triggers and things. And it was really easy to call and do these different bits and pieces. In fact, I wrote a blog post about it up on looselytyped.net, which is my blog. And I give it all the source code for at least the first two functions in there. I should really go update it for the third to show you how we're doing the geocoding. But it's a blog post called Parsing Azure Blob Storage Logs Using Azure Functions, and it's up on looselytyped.net.
Yeah, we'll make sure that that's in the show notes as well. Another thing that we did recently too was we actually spent a bunch of time with Orchard, and because it really doesn't have a lot of information specifically around the topic at hand here. I'll skim over some of it. I do plan on writing this up sometime in the next couple of weeks. But one of the cool things that we were able to do with Azure, specifically with Azure Web Apps, is that so Orchard is a CMS engine. All the data is stored in a database. In our case, it's an Azure SQL database. And the entire website is just ASP.NET. Now, you can get the website in one of two ways. You can grab it either, if you're a developer, there's a way you can go through and deploy it straight as just like an extension into an Azure Web App. But the way that I've done it is that you can either take the entire source code enlistment from GitHub, or you can actually take the built website code. And because I'm not really interested in doing a ton of Orchard development or dealing with all that stuff, I just take the resulting like website code base, and then I add in any custom themes. So I have a theme that I use for my site from andrewcollin.com. We have a custom theme we use for the microsoftcloudshow.com. Put those two themes in, and then there's about five or six custom third-party themes that we've added into the code base as well. Things for like Google Analytics, things for actually a custom module I wrote to support the podcast. That Orchard doesn't have podcasting support, so I wrote a module that does that. And in the last week, here's the dirty little secret. I'm sure we've mentioned this a couple times on Twitter, but over the last 2 years that we've been running this podcast, I guess about 2.5 years that we've been running this podcast, every time we've had a new episode, either CJ or I have literally downloaded an XML file, added in a new entry into the XML file and uploaded it. And we call that our RSS item. So when you've seen like a tweet go out that says, hey, a new episode is available for the podcast, that was coming from a blog post that we were able to schedule in Orchard, either on my blog or on CJ's blog or on the podcast blog. But you wouldn't see it show up in your feed on like iTunes, or you wouldn't see it show up in your feed, like in your Overcast or whatever app you use to listen to podcasts. And that's because either one of us forgot to do it, or one of us was on vacation, or one of us was at a conference and we simply couldn't get it done at the time. So we figured, oh, we'll just put the XML in a little bit later. But that thankfully has changed to where now I finally got the dynamic feed working. And the trick was it was taking way too long for it to render. I mean, today it's a half a meg file for the RSS feed. And it was taking, I think when I was measuring, it was taking close to 111 seconds just to build the XML. And I had to finally go in and set up some slick caching stuff that now it renders actually very, very fast.
Yeah, this is all in aid of automating our lives more, AC, and I love it.
It took us way too long to do it, but I hope you might also notice, though, that the site is much, much faster. It's going to get even faster because we actually found a bug in the caching that Orchard uses, and there's a PR that's already been submitted. It'll be in the next update, so when we update the site, it'll do it. But here's what's cool about this, what we did with Azure. So I was able to go in and to have the code base all running locally, site look great and everything locally. Now, I have a GitHub repo. It's a public repo. If you go to GitHub, just github.com/AndrewConnell/ACI-OrchardCMSProd. What you'll see is that's the repo that runs my entire Orchard deployment. But what's interesting in there is that, number one, there's no secret information in there. Like there's no database connection strings or tenant information or any of that kind of stuff. The way it works is that there's two different branches in there. There's a master branch and a dev branch. So I'm going to get into a little bit of the nuts and bolts like you did with the functions here and explain how this works. I have an Azure website set up or Azure web app, and that web app has four slots associated with it. So there's just the normal slot for where the production site is. So if you go to www.microsoftcloudshow.com or www.andrewconnell.com, that's going to that deployment. That one is set up with a bunch of settings inside of app settings inside of the Azure web app to look to an Azure storage account to find the information about each of the different tenants. So like what's the connection string, what's the URLs it should be listening for, what's the prefix in the database, all that stuff. It also stores all the media inside those tenants. So I have one Azure storage account, one blob store that's called Orchard Prod, and my main site set up that way. I have a slot, another deployment slot that's set up, which is just kind of like a copy of the website, is set up called staging. So I've got DNS entries, CNAMEs pointing to my staging site. So it's, what is it? If you go to staging.microsoftcloudshow.com, it might or might not render. It depends on if I have the slot actually running at the time. If I'm not doing a deployment, I generally don't have it running just to save performance on the web server. And then that one is tied to the master branch in GitHub. So whenever I do a push to master, GitHub notifies Azure. Azure reaches in automatically, does a pull, grabs all the code base from what's running over in GitHub, and it applies all that code to the staging branch. I then have eyes on to make sure that the site actually works over in staging, that nothing is broken. It's using production data, still pointing to production database and all that stuff. And then I just go into Azure Web App and I just say swap, and it swaps production staging around so that now within a few seconds, things usually break for a few seconds because it's changing IPs around and web servers recycling and stuff. But things are just going to go through. It's going to deploy the site. So I can deploy all my code up into production, make sure it works. And before it does, and make it live to everybody, I just switch it around.
Nice.
I've also got another slot called INT. INT stands for integration. That one's tied to the dev branch. But that slot is configured differently in the sense that it's looking at a development database. And so that's where I can, you know, bang away. I've also got a fourth slot called WIP, work in progress. And what the work in progress does is it allows me to have any kind of feature branches I'm working on for my Orchard deployment. I can push directly to it. I don't push to GitHub. I push directly to it to test those things out. And it also uses dev. But what was so cool about it is that I was doing ASP.NET, a lot of ASP.NET work on my MacBook, and I was pushing those changes straight up to GitHub or straight to Azure on my work in progress to make sure things worked. And once they did, I just pushed over to dev, watched the whole continuous deployment thing flow. Once it did, I updated master, pushed it, watched it all flow straight over to staging. Everything worked good. Go into Azure, flip them around. It's great. It makes it so much more reliable. I don't have to worry about, you know, what does my deployment story look like? Because I'm used to pushing to a Git repo. Specifically, I'm used to pushing to GitHub. I do that multiple times a day. And all I know is that with this site, I just treat master. Master is what production is, what the .com site looks like. So it's a really cool setup. It's really cool to have all of your configuration stuff is all outside of your code base. And it really just makes life, as a developer, it makes it so much easier to go through and to push rollouts and see how things work. And if there's a bug, it can easily get fixed. So
yeah,
I have written about this on my blog in the past. I'm going to write about it again because I've kind of made some additional changes to it. But if you go to my repo up in GitHub, again, it's just github.com/AndrewConnell and look for the repo named ACI-OrchardCMS or Orchard CMS prod. I can't remember which one it is. And that is our entire deployment. I've added an extra docs folder where I use to document stuff for my benefit on how I set it up, because like last time I had made a bunch of changes to Orchard back in October of last year, about 10 months ago, 7-8 months ago, something like that. And I never pushed them up and I forgot where I left it off and I had to start all over again this past week. So,
ouch.
Yeah. But anyway, it makes it so much easier. And I mean, there's things you can do this with other clouds too, but Azure makes it so simple.
Yeah. End-to-end developer productivity, right? It's nice.
Oh yeah, it really is.
So there's a little bit about how we use Azure, right? We host our site there. We've got Orchard running up there. We use Blob Storage for MP3s. We're using Azure Storage Logs for analysis and analytics of who's listening to our shows and where and all that sort of stuff. And then off into Excel and Google Docs for reporting and things. So
App Insights and
yes,
cool custom dashboards. And we're even thinking about using Redis as well. I can hook Redis up to Orchard as well. So we can see if that makes it even faster. I'm pretty happy with a sub 2-second response time,
it's
though.
It's much nicer than it was. Well done.
This week, you should notice a difference in the site. It's going to get even better too, but you should notice a difference in the site now and the speed as well. There's one more thing we're going to do where we turn on file caching. That's pretty cool because with Azure Web Apps, this is a little trivia thing for you. Azure Web Apps, if you have multiple instances of the same Azure Web App, they all share the same underlying virtual disk. And so if you do like output caching, but you use in-memory output caching, if a user hits server A, they're going to cache the home page. But if that same user hits server B, it's not going to use the cache version because the cache version is in memory on server A. What the file caching does is it will use output caching, but instead of putting it in memory, it puts it on disk inside the app data folder so that all of the instances get the same cache object from server A. Server C can get the same cached object as well. When it expires on one, it expires on all of them.
Yeah, gotcha. That's going to be miles quicker.
Yeah, we just had there's a URL length issue that's going on. But
very nice.
Yeah. We've been going on and on about this. I think we have to do our picks here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, let's do some picks.
You got a pick? Okay. I'll let you go first.
I have one pick. Yeah, raygun.io. For all the developers out there, Raygun, we're hoping to actually get them on the show at some point to talk about this because they're obviously all around the cloud and it's pretty interesting what they're doing. But they make two products, a crash reporting product and what they call Pulse. And so the two products are for developers who want to integrate crash reporting and analytics into their apps. And so that whether that be a cloud-based web app, a mobile app, what have you. You know, very easy, a couple of snippets of code into your application, and then you're getting real-time crash reporting and analytics in a nice, easy-to-use cloud-based web app. And the cool thing is they're doing quite smart bucketing of errors. So, for example, if you get a bunch of a particular error, you don't see, you know, 1,000 of the same error. You see one of those with a count beside it. And they do smart aggregation of those errors based on the stack trace. And they might not be identical, but they look close enough that they get bucketed together. So, for example, you know, your stack might be different between one user and another, but it's the same error, so they'll stuff them together into the same bucket. It's quite interesting. Anyway, we're hoping to get them on the show to talk about how they do it. The other one is Pulse, which is another one of these products. I just point out we're not sponsored by these guys at all. This is just the reason I'm bringing them up is because we use them at Hyperfish, and I'm having a good time using them. Plus, they're a company originally from New Zealand, so that's how I heard about them first. But Raygun Pulse is real-time user monitoring, so things like page load times, performance analytics about how users are doing, seeing where they're having issues, and monitoring people in real time in your applications. It's just such an easy app to use. It's done really nicely, and we're having a good experience with them. I'm using them in WPF application that I was building. I talked about XAML, using them in that one, and we're also using it in our cloud service as well. So it's a pretty cool tool. So raygun.io.
So .NET, and is it using your service? You're node-based, right?
Oh, yeah. They cover all of the bases. JavaScript.NET, PHP, Ruby, iOS, ColdFusion, ASP.NET, Android, Python, Google App Engine, Xamarin, Windows Phone, Django, Play, Angular, Nancy, Scala, Cake, Java, Node, Unity, Windows RT, and WordPress.
Oh my goodness.
Plus and more.
If you're familiar with Raygun, what, the competitor, like say, you might have heard of New Relic.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, we use New Relic as well. So, but the difference is we use New Relic for our infrastructure monitoring, whereas we use these guys really for our app monitoring, our code monitoring. It really gives us a first alert dashboard of what's going on in our application, which then we go dig into tools like New Relic and like Kibana and Elasticsearch to go find more detail about why something might have happened. But we use Raygun is the sort of the front end for all of that stuff to alert us to what's going on in our app.
Gotcha. Very cool.
Yeah, it's
very cool. So I have one pick. It's somewhat developer related, but it's also, well, let's go with the space kick here. Back on April 11th, this article hit TechCrunch. NASA troubleshoots the Kepler spacecraft from 75 million miles away.
Wow.
This stuff blows my mind. I mean, when someone says on the software side, when they're like, oh, no, you can't do this, or no, you can't do that, or when stuff crashes, it goes, no, there's just no way to go through and debug something like this. I always think back to stories like this, or I think back to like when NASA put the Curiosity rover up, right? That one was when the Curiosity rover left Earth on its way to Mars, the software wasn't done. And on the way, they did a firmware update to load Curiosity with all the stuff that it needed to be able to land. So it went through the entire landing. Once it landed, it confirmed it was landed. It didn't have any software to be able to drive around because they had just a minimal amount of memory on there to be able to use it. And when the thing landed, they then uploaded another firmware to say, here's how you drive around. It overwrote the firmware to land because we're landed. We don't need that anymore. And it had like two computers and be able to like work on one and send the other one. I mean, imagine bricking a machine like that from millions of miles away.
Awkward.
Exactly. Yeah. Rough day. So there were actually two stories that came out about this recently. One was about Kepler and one was about a Japanese satellite. So the Kepler, what happened is on April the 7th, during a scheduled contact, the mission operations engineers discovered that Kepler was in emergency mode. Now, what that means, that's the first time that had ever happened in its 7-year lifetime. And NASA's still trying to figure out exactly why it went that way. But just think about this from the developers and you. Just think about like what this meant, right? So Kepler was, first of all, it's already exceeded its expected lifetime. So they're just really running off of bonus time right now with Kepler. But it still has, this is, and if you're familiar with Kepler, this is the one that found the, like, Earth 2.0. It found the potential, its job was to find Earth-like planets. And what this did, when it bricked, what happened when it went into emergency mode, it didn't brick, sorry, but when it went into emergency mode, that meant that it was going to be on, meant that it was able to, it had to send the coverage, it went into like high fuel mode, but also in very in much conservation. What NASA had to do, this article goes through the entire process of how they had to get control over it, how they had to get priority coverage on the Deep Space Network. That's the three different radio telescopes around the world that give us full coverage, and how they were able to communicate with it, get it out of emergency mode. It's really interesting how they were able to do it, like what the things that they have to end up dealing with. And I mean, every time you send a transmission to Kepler and it responds back, it takes 13 minutes with a transmission traveling at the speed of light to get there and back.
The ability to debug that just blows my mind.
You think that this whole, like what we talked about at the beginning, what the road to hell is paved with SAML assertions, and imagine the engineer that had to make the bug fix, like put the if statement in there and then roll it out, that was in front of all of Office 365. And if that breaks, then you bring down all of 365. But if this breaks, there's no like, go plug in this USB stick.
Instead of plug and play, it's patch and pray.
It's pretty crazy. It was pretty interesting though. So they're still going trying to figure out what happened here. And yeah, that's my pick for the week.
That's really cool. Yeah. I'm glad I don't have to write software. Well, I would like to write software that was used in places like that, but I'm kind of glad I don't have to debug software in places like that.
Yeah, it's a fun challenge. But at any rate, well, hey, busy show, a lot of news, a lot of behind the scenes how we run this, and a couple good picks here.
Excellent.
So, all right, CJ, well, thanks a lot for another great show, and I guess we will tune in with everybody sometime next week.
See you next week.
See ya.
If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text. We'll record it as a WAV or an MP3 file and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Eric by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can find us on Facebook searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.